You're listening to the Founder Podcast Series, your source for inspiration and insights from successful entrepreneurs from the Yale community. I'm Nathaniel Johnson, and I'm here with my co-host, Elena Derevyanko, to inspire and encourage an entrepreneurial mindset among those who possess an inclination towards innovation without being dissuaded by inherent risks. We believe that even the brightest minds can be discouraged from pursuing their entrepreneurial dreams, and we want to change that. On our podcast, we interview successful entrepreneurs and share their insights and firsthand experiences to provide valuable lessons for our listeners. We hope that through these conversations, we can inspire and empower you to pursue your passions and turn your ideas into reality. Today, we have with us Tom Lehman, co-founder and former CEO of Genius, a platform for users to provide annotations and interpretations to song lyrics, news stories, poetry, and more. Genius was recently acquired by Media Labs and now holds a net worth of $160 million. We are more than privileged to have Tom join us on our pod to share his insights and firsthand experiences in becoming a successful entrepreneur.
We are so very happy to have you here, and welcome to the Yale Entrepreneurial Society podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Yelena, and...
And I'm Nathaniel Johnson. Our vision here is to create a platform for entrepreneurs to share their insights to fellow Yalies and want to build variable solutions, curious to learn, and who want to build innovations in their own niche. So let's start this off by...
Yeah, did we meet at the thing?
Yeah, of course we did.
Going on. Yeah, okay, got it. Yeah. Okay, now so we know each other. Good. Yeah, great. Of course, yeah. Great, yeah. Happy to be here. This is a cool thing.
Yeah. So why don't we get started? Let's set the scene, kind of the journey, right, that Genius kind of took. What sort of story or, I guess, experiences kind of led you to realizing that one day you would become an entrepreneur?
It's a good question. I always say that, like, you know, the stereotype is someone who really knows what they want to do, you know, who knows, like, and has a passion for, you know, whatever, you know, entrepreneurship and related things like technology and building stuff. And, you know, from an early age, I had a passion, and that's the sort of stereotype. And I think, you know, just as often in life, at least for me, you know, it's not really like that. You kind of have to figure out what is even going on, what's in the world, before you can know, like, what you want to do. So I had no idea I wanted to do anything with entrepreneurship or building things or anything like that. When I was in college, I was very interested in philosophy. I was very interested in economics. I majored in some things. One of my majors was a thing called ethics, politics, and economics, an iconic Yale major. And in this major, I wrote my senior paper on eminent domain. And basically what eminent domain is when the government is allowed, because building a highway, it's allowed to, you know, take your house from you, basically, if it pays. And these kinds of questions, like, when is it okay for the government to take your house? So I was really into law, really into economics. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to law school, and that's going to be my next tier of, you know, academic success, because that's something I've been good at. And so I can get more of that. And then I decided, sort of pivotally, wisely, I guess, in retrospect, to go live in New York for a year first. And the reason for that was basically, you know, some abstract notion of it being good to have a job a little bit before being in school, but New York seemed appealing and all my friends were doing it. So I decided to move to New York, and I got a job at a hedge fund where I was basically doing tech support. So my first job was tech support, and it was not something that I found particularly interesting, and, you know, kind of probably would not have done if I didn't think it was temporary, which is like kind of another idea of, like, you know, doing stuff that, you know, you don't like to do, and maybe that can lead to something, even if doesn't seem that way. You know, I was, you know, in school, you're very much like, okay, I'm going to choose my path. You know, I'm going to, you know, choose the major, choose my courses, you know, I'm going to choose my path, and I'm going to have that be a well-chosen thing. Whereas, you know, that can kind of, like, distract you from, like, doing something that, you know, maybe, or make it seem worse to do something that, like, doesn't seem as, you know, as appealing. But anyway, I was working in tech support. I met some people who were interested in technology. I started to do some programming, started to do some, you know, product management, basically trying to think about a website in terms of how it should work to get something done, not just like whether it's, you know, pretty or whatever. And I found it to be very interesting, very appealing. And that's when I sort of started, like, you know what, building stuff is kind of fun, you know, it'd be fun to do this. And, you know, I had some notion that it would be good to not have a job. And so I was trying to, like, figure out a way to do that. did not think it would be genius, did not think it would be something that was, you know, kind of a social, you know, thing where there's no way to make money initially. Like, that was not my plan. I worked on a couple of different things. One of them was a sheets company called Bomb Sheets. Worked on that with some people who ended up being collaborators on Genius, one of whom was my co-founder, Alon. And that was kind of the model that I had in my head was, let's build a website that sells sheets. Let's build something that's simple, that makes money. And then Genius kind of just came up as, you know, a lucky kind of weird idea that was, I mean, it wasn't a weird idea, but it was like a weird combination of all these things working out at the same time, having some time on my hands, wanting to build stuff, having people around me who were, you know, experts in, you know, decoding lyrics, and having myself be so interested in the topic because I was new to hip hop lyricism. And like, you know, it was a true, there should be a website for this moment, but it was not based around an idea that I wanted to do something in entrepreneurship. And even when I wanted to do something in entrepreneurship, it was like the opposite of what I was trying to do, basically, which is, you know, start something that was a, you know, get big and figure it out kind of thing. But it was just a very, very appealing idea. And I was working with some very talented people, and that's kind of what happened. And then, you know, the next 12 years of my life were preordained from that moment, which is sort of a weird thought that it can all be, you know, preordained from a moment.
That is very inspiring for all the Yalies who are right now looking for ideas and ways to build their own thing, but they're not quite sure. They're hesitant in all the possibilities and explorations that the marketplace opens up. And following up on that, how would you evaluate all the rising niches and identify like solutions to those marketplaces, market segments that are needed?
It's a good question. So if you, you know, I used to do podcasts too, and I was a the CEO of Genius working until the end of last year, a little over a year ago when we sold the company. I used to do podcasts too. I would have conversations, and I would even get asked questions like, you know, and I have no idea. So this is one sort of just thing about me and my headspace. Like, you know, when I was a CEO of Genius and when I think you're doing something like that in a real way, like not like, you know, okay, this is getting going and we're exploring, but like, okay, we have a board meeting coming up. We need the revenue to be this. You don't have time to think about anything. So that's like a hidden cost and something I really learned about this year, because there's a lot going on. And if you ignore it all, which you have to do as the CEO of a startup, you can miss out. So now I've had some time, I've had some thoughts. I spent the last year basically working in the niche of Web3. Which is, you know, not the most, you know, not the best term now. I feel like it's gotten kind of, people don't like Web3 basically now, a lot of people, but I do. I think it's an amazing, you know, it's an amazing thing that I, you know, had bought, you know, I kind of knew basically what Bitcoin was and Ethereum sort of was, and I'd bought the currency, but, you know, it was this year from just kind of like looking at the situation, like actually a little bit below skin depth, that I sort of realized, you know, what was actually going on with this, or the beginning of what was going on this platform, which is basically this idea that, you know, you can have a computer that no one can stop you from using, you know, and this was incredibly philosophically seductive for me. And, you know, there are a couple reasons for this, but one big reason was that, you know, in working at Genius, and there have been various episodes at Genius specifically, but just the overall idea of, you're a small company, you're playing in a bigger, you have something very, very, very special, but you are playing with people who have big advantages against you. And how does that work itself out? So in the case of Google, for example, you know, Google was our biggest friend, you know, in the beginning, and they still, you know, I don't know, you know, still today even, right? Of course, they're still our great, great friend in terms of driving traffic. And by that basically just means providing a service to people who want lyrics. You Google lyrics, you want to find out the best source for lyrics. Genius was, is the best source. And so Google directs you to it. But soon we found ourselves competing with Google, basically. And by that, I mean, Google would have their own lyrics that would go above Genius's lyrics results. So if you were Googling lyrics, instead of seeing Genius at the top, which, you know, we have the best ones, you would see Google at the top, and you would see Google at the top every single time, no matter what. You know, maybe we didn't have the best ones like here and there, but every single time Google would be at the top. And to make matters worse, Google is taking the lyrics that they put there from our website, from Genius. And so when we discovered this, we did a whole, you can read about it in the Wall Street Journal, it was a whole big thing of like embedding secret codes in the lyrics that would be reproduced. It was like a whole cool and very cute and fun thing. But when we discovered it, we thought, okay, well, surely they'll stop. You know, right? Like, we caught them. You know, that we caught them in a way that is impossible to dispute. And you know, they didn't stop, and it was a whole thing, and it's ongoing in some ways. But the point being, if you're an entrepreneur out there, or rather, forget that, if you're a person using Google, you might have stumbled across the place where Google, you know, copies and pastes, you know, content from another person's site and puts it in Google. And you might think to yourself, oh, that's kind of convenient for me. I wonder if the person's website, do they like that when their stuff gets copied and pasted into Google? Well, whatever, it's here for me. I, you know, it's fine. Like, that was my attitude first. That's a normal attitude. So, like, you're focused on yourself. That's normal. That's it. But then there's a broader ecosystem at play, a broader thing going on where Google or whomever it is, but taking Google together, is just does whatever it wants. And so if you don't like that, that Google's copying your website, you can't do anything about it. That's the key problem. And it's actually bad, right? Because if Google is, you know, copying all these sites, then, you know, you can't afford to exist and have anything for anyone to read or copy or whatever. So having an experience of Google wanting to do X and you wanting to do Y is a crucial experience, I think, for anyone living in this world, because you don't know what Google is about or any of these guys are about if they side with you, which is what happens most of the time. But, you know, when they don't, you kind of think, okay, these guys have absolute power. They can't be stopped in any way. Maybe government will stop them. I don't know. They can't be stopped in any way. What are we going to do? You know, do we hand over the keys and say, hey, here are the keys to everything, all communication, all computation, everything you want to do, basically, that's electronic. Here's the keys. You know, the only thing that we can maintain is the ability to have a private computer in our house and host a website on that, which is basically extremely difficult to do and impossible. And so I think giving the keys is bad. And I think Ethereum and other similar, you know, general purpose Turing complete blockchains is an amazing kind of, you know, bulwark against that. Like, you know, you can have a cloud computer that, you know, Google can't shut you down for. So, you know, I think that's a really important thing. And then also, I just think in general, like having a, you know, the concept of like kind of a neutral layer that's still hooked up to the computer. You know, it's something, you know, not, you know, it's a neutral cloud computer where, you know, two people can even, you know, if I'm working with someone and, you know, there's some, you know, collaboration where you have to use my Amazon account or there's some, I'm hosting a file for you even, just like, well, fine. Like, you know, just go to this, my, this spreadsheet where we can record this stuff. It's all fine, but it's like a very interesting, you know, exercise when, you know, people can, you know, actually just have like this neutrality when you are, you know, keeping track of who owes who money or these kinds of things. So I think Ethereum and Web3 stuff like that is very, very important. I think we're probably early on it. You're supposed to say we're early. We're early on it. I mean, AI, the other big one, of course. I have less direct experience with AI. I've used the recent chat bot thing, and I think it's pretty cool. I think, you know, I have a young daughter. It's pretty terrifying to think about what is going to happen, you know, in terms of AI and this kind of, you know, taking over everything. You know, I've played with image generation, played this stuff. It's like 3 years has been, you know, this is fairly trite observation, but let me say that my potential small injection is like one of the smaller groups of people who've seen it. And as a kid, you could really appreciate, wow, this is going to be a totally different landscape. But my day-to-day is more focused on the programming Ethereum side.
I see you are very appreciative and very aware of all the technologies that are emerging, as well as uses for them, as well as cautious. In the sense of being aware about the power that those innovations possess. How do you approach like taking on drastic changes or taking on drastic modifications according to how those innovations go in the future? How do you see Genius or your work or anything else career-wise? In that sense.
It's interesting because, you know, I think there are kind of two contrary things in the sense that, like, you know, what I mentioned earlier, where I'm like, okay, you're coming from Yale or something like that. You've probably, you know, had some record of achievement. And for what's next, you really want to have it be good, basically. You know, that's one mindset. And if you really want something to be good, you want to consider different options. You really want to think about it. And what you lose in that process is the learning that doing something that's not good will give you, right? Like if you think about, you know, yourself and how dumb you are, you know, or smart you are, but say how dumb you are. Ideally, you are getting less dumb over time, right? Like you're the dumbest you'll ever be. That's the ideal scenario, and probably true for at least some period of time. So you're getting less dumb over time. Why make a decision when you are the dumbest you'll ever be? Why don't you make a decision in the future to be less dumb? Get some experience first. And so this is why I would encourage, you know, everyone to consider my experience of coming out of college and not trying to think, oh, I need to have a really good job. I need to work at, you know, whatever, McKinsey, or I have a job that has a good name on it. You know, I did have a job at like a cool place to work, a hedge fund where people were smart and all this kind of stuff. I learned a lot of stuff, but I didn't try to get like, you know, trader, you know, cool trader or whatever. I was like, you know, help desk guy, you know, technical support. And, you know, if you're in the right place with the right people, you can learn something, then you can figure out what you actually want to do and do something, you know, maybe more important. And this is the same that goes from figuring out what idea you want to work on is just try a bunch of different things and see how they all feel. So this is a philosophy I call worse is better. It's a philosophy that is, you know, embraces the, you know, the importance of iterative improvement over picking the right thing from the start. So if you can get better faster and faster, or, you know, if you can get better quickly, that's going to dominate your ability to choose the initial thing really, really well. The problem is that when it comes to, fast changing, you know, situations, you can actually have a pretty big cost to, you know, choosing wrong. You know, I think, you know, this is the counterpoint. So for example, in my experience with Web3, like I'm trying to think like, okay, balancing, you know, these two facts. So I'm trying to do a bunch of stuff, just getting out there, programming, releasing NFTs, you know, just trying to like do stuff. I'm basically like a freelancer kind of at this point is one, you know, way to put it. I'm out there trying to build technology, but I am not at this moment trying to go out and say, hey, like, what can I raise money for to do as a startup? Because once you do that, you are really locked in. And I remember being locked in at Genius. You can't look at anything else, and locking yourself in, you know, or even, you know, picking something to work on for a period of time, like maybe not even raising money, like, you know, you are going to miss out on, you know, more when the area is growing more. So like in this Web3 situation, you know, and AI or any of these areas, just waiting another couple of months can yield a lot of difference. When you're trying to choose, should I work at, you know, a consulting firm or a hedge fund? Probably that is a different sort of scenario. So, you know, for me right now, and also like, I don't know how much more, you know, stuff I want to, you know, do, you know, I got a family and everything now. It's like when you're younger, it's I think a little easier to just go crazy or whatever, but I have to choose a little more carefully. But yeah, I would say it's good to err on the side of not stressing it out too much. But you should think about in fast-growing areas how much information you can get just by doing, you know, nothing, which typically you don't get very much information at all from doing nothing. You have to do things to get information, but sometimes you can't. But basically, I'm glad that I took the approach when I was getting started of trying a bunch of different things and worrying more about, you know, speed of iteration and improvement and quality of improvement versus quality of initially, you know, first release.
Yeah. So I know, as you mentioned, when people come out of college, right, it's often a big push made by family, friends to kind of, you know, get that big job and work from there. And I see that almost, you know, kind of just taking it slow and not having that pressure can also, I guess, lead to a sense of innovation, entrepreneurship, as it did for yourself. But you also mentioned how, you know, in this transition, I would say from, let's say, Web 2 to Web 3, right, you know, Web 3 is more decentralized. You have users able to kind of connect with each other rather than through a centralized service. But in the Web 2 spaces we currently are in, it's more centralized. And you kind of also mentioned how Google was, you know, in somewhat competition, right? At first, it was more helping you. And then all of a sudden, it was more like you had to compete. So how, I guess, would that somewhat decentivize, say, a future entrepreneur from taking on that risk? Say that they were, you know, taking it slow, as you said. How best should they kind of look at that obstacle or maybe an opportunity of there being such a big conglomerate in the current tech industry?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I wouldn't really say taking it slow. Like what I would say that I advocate is not putting too much pressure on yourself to get it right in the first version. And whether that's the first version of a piece of software or the first version of like you as a job person, having a job, like your first job, you know, version one, if version one is, there's a saying, if version one is good, then you waited too long to launch. And that's about software. It could have could mean other things too. Version one of, you know, I don't know, version one of your job is amazing. Maybe you waited too long to take a job. Now, the thing you should have taken in slow is improvement. So you pick your version, you pick your spot for version one, and then you try to improve as quickly as possible. And I think, you know, in the context of a job, you know, it's harder than with software because you can't just like get a promotion whenever you want, but you can, you know, work hard. And if it's a good place, you know, typically that is rewarded, not necessarily literally rewarded in terms of getting more money, but you get on people's radar as someone who does stuff. And then you meet someone and that person does another thing and your network and all this kind of stuff. It's just a process of getting on, you know, or if you're writing software for free, this is another example, writing software for free, you don't get paid for it, right? But it gets you on the radar of people who are looking for stuff. And, you know, doing a good job, you probably don't get paid for it too, you know, that kind of thing. Same. Now, once you get in the position of being a manager or someone trying to hire someone, a hiring manager, what you'll realize is you're desperate to find anyone who can do anything. So you'll be thinking, okay, who's written software for free? Who's good? You know, who's good? You know, it's like most people do not really do that much. Like, don't really try that hard. I mean, this is the fact, you know, it should be inspiring in a way. Like, just people just don't do that much. Now, people who do a lot are often in, you know, client facing positions, you know, or working freelance or in some kind of way that they really have to like, you know, bill. But a lot of people who are working jobs for salaries with internal clients, you know, it's just, you can make an impact by and get on people's radar by doing more. So that's what I really mean by lower pressure, just lower pressure to have an amazing solution initially, and still high pressure to, or whatever, medium high pressure to, you know, improve your situation, get on people's radar. You know, I think, yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to, you know, these new areas, Web 2 and Web 3, I just think it is so powerful to put out software. I mean, this is my lens. I was not a software engineer in college. I didn't learn programming there. I didn't learn it when I was 13 or whatever. As I mentioned, it's often the stereotype. I learned it when I was 23 and 24, still pretty young in the grand scheme. It was a really good move to learn it because I still program every day, you know, especially now. And so if you can start early, you get some compound interest sort of stuff going on where the benefits accrue and are worth, you know, a lot more than starting late and even being very good quickly. But programming, you know, you can put it out there and other people can look at it and read it and it and test whether it works, you know, and that's a hugely powerful thing. If you have good ideas on a product, you know, good solutions, you can't just put that out there. Like when you go and see a website, you know, this is something people would do. You go and see a website and say, hey, here are, you know, Genius. Here are all my suggestions for how to make Genius the website better. And it's like, okay, well, first of all, not many people could come up with something good for that. So thank you. But at the same time, there's probably a zillion reasons why the thing you propose won't work. Like any website that looks like, why don't they do it like this? This is obviously bad. Like there are reasons it's like that. You can't see them. And so there's no way to really say, is this person good at website suggestions? Because to actually be good at website suggestions, you have to go into the organization. You have to look at all the details and all the history and say, okay, this is the right balance of solving all these different problems and having these trade-offs, whatever. That's the way that you suggest changes to a website. But if you build your own website and, you know, ideally if you write your own code, then it's like, you can tell if it works. You just visit the website and see. And so that's why I think programming, you know, and building in general is so, so powerful. And in Web3, it's great because all the code's open source. This was something I was shocked by. You know, in Web 2, the JavaScript is sort of quasi open source or open source because it is, you know, on the clients, on the browser, but the server side code is the secret. You know, in Web 3, the server side code, AKA the contract side code, the smart contract, the, you know, Ethereum side code is the most important to be public because it's the thing that can scam you. So all this stuff is public. So that means anything you see, you can just copy paste and put your own spin on it. And anyone can see your stuff and copy paste that, put their own spin on it and see if you're good at something. So I think that's really an AI, I guess, is kind of the opposite. AI can do everything. So you kind of obscures what you did maybe, or I don't know much about, you know, but yeah, I think Web3 is amazing. But that's what I did. You know, when I was trying to find people to work with and find people who, you know, and find ways I could make money and all this kind of stuff, I started by just putting out a ton of things that I thought was cool and then met people and kind of went from there. So yeah, I think it's unfortunate really, because I think programming is also not important. in the sense that there, I don't think has ever been a problem that a business had that was like technical. I mean, that's wrong, but like for Genius or, you know, maybe super technical situations, but like Genius, you know, big website, a lot of tech problems to solve, one of the biggest websites, engineering. And we had a great, amazing engineering team and whatever, but like, you know, if you could figure out what to build and how to tie that to business success, that is so much more important than being good at building it. So programming is super important because someone has to do it and it has to be done well, but also it cannot exist in isolation, but for the purpose of putting yourself out there, I think it's really good.
Yeah. So you keep encouraging, you know, in the sense for people to kind of aspire to learn how to code, you know, become more of innovators. The sense of like, that's a good example. You're saying you're looking at a website. It's almost is, why don't you try to build your own in a sense of learning what it takes to build it, what aspects are needed more than commenting on something else. But I guess in the general sense of entrepreneurship, you sometimes see that people are sometimes dissuaded based on, let's say, if they think they're somewhat born with that ability to create, or rather they develop it over time. So would you say that that development of ability comes more of like, let's say, an intrinsic passion to create, or is it somewhat fostered in, I guess, in a certain environment?
Tough question. I mean, I think there is no, I'll tell you, you know, you don't have to start when you're young. Certainly I proved that, you know, that, I mean, I was young, but I was in 13. You don't have to be great at, you know, math. I mean, I did major in like math and philosophy, but it's not really like a true hard math thing. You know, I think the top tier of people, the technical excellence, you know, you're going to find, yeah, really smart math people, physics people, like people who are quote unquote really smart, where I consider myself pretty smart. Like, and by that, I mean, like I can figure it out, but like there is a huge range of what it means to be a programmer. And if you want to build Ethereum, you got to be really smart. That's probably ways, you know, bye-bye, that way bye-bye to most of us. That's me, certainly. If you want to program on Ethereum, then you can do it. You know, I promise you, if you're listening to this podcast, you know, you can do it. And so you're partially, it's finding that area, you know, application programming versus systems programming. Like there are also people programming on Ethereum at higher levels by a lot than I am, writing, you know, the infrastructure for stuff that I would use, like the fastest way to calculate the length of a string on Ethereum, which is like, for some reason, not that easy to do, or whatever, not that easy to do fast. So yeah, it's about finding that niche, but I think the niche for someone who wants to put out a product that someone can play with, that's pretty broad. And yeah, it's about not giving up. It's about working hard. You know, it is something where, you know, you're not going to be, especially if you're, again, on the younger side, trying to get into the game, you're not going to be able to take, you know, that many breaks from it. You know, I mean, it sucks. I'm not a sort of like hustle, you know, glorifying, like work every second type of, you know, guy, stay up all night working, whatever. Like, I don't think that's, you know, helpful, but I definitely, you know, I work, and, you know, certainly getting started, you know, if not 7 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week is probably not a good idea, but, you know, so, you know, it's just like, you got to put in the time. You know, I've spent a lot of time recently with my kid, and I, you know, like to hang out with her, and I like to juggle. I decided to learn, okay, I'm going to juggle, because I think that's something that I can do that will amuse her. And also, you know, it's a way to kind of just hang out where I'm not tempted to look at my phone. And I don't know if you both can juggle. I think, you know, if you can look at someone juggling and say like, oh my God, now I can juggle three balls. So it's like, you know, four or five, you know, there are people who are like a zillion times better, but those are the people who are building Ethereum, right? Like, you can, anyone can juggle, literally anyone can juggle. And the question is, when you start trying to do it, it's like, this is impossible, I'll never do this. But then do you keep practicing or not? Same thing as ceramics. I'm a big ceramics guy. I haven't done it in a little bit because of moving houses, all this kind of stuff. But go to tomlehmanceramics.com, bunch of shows up there, a bunch of cool stuff. And same thing, practice. Someone says, I want to be good at ceramics. Like, anyone can be good at ceramics. You know, it's not composing a symphony. You can't be good at that. That's building Ethereum, which you also can't do. But you could do ceramics, just make 1,000 pop. So I just think, you know, most people are not willing to put in the work, but it's really not about the work. It's most people lose faith, lose hope, aren't willing to, you know, give themselves the benefit of the doubt. There's no way that you can ever prove that you can't learn how to juggle or learn how to program. You can prove you can't write a symphony, I think, but you can't prove you can't learn how to juggle. The only way you accept that conclusion is if you lose faith in yourself, which you should not do. But you also probably shouldn't try to compose a symphony. Or maybe you should. I have no musical background. I have no juggling background either. Sort of speaking from that standpoint, if you're already good at music, that's kind of a different story.
That is actually so inspiring for everyone to hear that is looking to build their own thing, start their own thing, but are not sure if they actually have it. Just to like follow up on the thing that you said about Ethereum and jumping on, and anyone can learn that. What is kind of the path that Genius is taking on right now? Is it something new? Is it something has to do with Web3? Is it jumping on Web3 or maybe the NFT space? Or is there anything else you're currently working on or looking forward to kind of driving the strategy into a new way?
Sure. I mean, for Genius, you know, I can speak to it a little bit, but I'm not, you know, the Genius is in amazing hands right now. It was bought by a company called Media Lab, which is a holding company of digital media companies, especially companies that have, you know, the profile of Genius, which is very significant, websites and engaged audiences, kind of like looking at ways to help these companies optimize their situation. You know, so like Genius was doing a ton of things on its own, you know, whether it's HR, ad tech, all these kind of things. And Media Lab has really helped us scale those things up and, you know, do, you know, kind of, you know, have make more money and do a better job with our users and all this stuff at less cost. So that's been amazing. One, you know, downside is that for me personally, which has actually been an upside, because I think the you know, what's been really important to me in the Genius sort of you know, saga in my life has just been like the desire to create something that would last and be something users could go to and like, and you know, people who wrote annotations 12 years ago can go to the site and look up their annotation and say written 12 years ago. Like, that's cool to me. You know, it's like hard. No one can do that, basically. And when I say no one, I mean like even me. It's really, really hard to build something that lasts when it comes to the internet style thing. Very, very hard. And so, when I was running Genius towards the end, we were break even, but like, this is not, you know, enough. So I think what Media Lab really brought is the ability to, you know, supercharge Genius's ability to make money, but also its longevity. And that's an amazing thing. And it's also done some other cool things too, like be able to kind of launch and this I really shouldn't speak about, because like I'm not, you know, directly involved, but I am super on board with the vision, which is launching a kind of way to serve artists more directly as like kind of a record label, which is something that I really wanted to do, but we didn't have the bandwidth for. But, you know, one quasi sad thing is that I haven't, and I'm no longer the, you know, the boss. I've handed it over, and I'm super happy that I did that. And I think Genius is way better off than it was under my running it at the end, because we're in a much better situation, you know, financially, but I am not the, I'm not in charge of kind of like driving the vision. You know, I still, and part of the company and still helping. But I think this is like just an important thing to bring up, because, you know, if you are working on something and you are lucky enough to be able to create something that lasts, and you are lucky enough to be able to, you know, hand it off to someone who, you know, the perfect company run by, you know, amazing people, you still are going to have to think, okay, well, you know, what about the time that I had? And that was kind of limited in retrospect. And so when it comes to Genius, just the thing that I would, you know, I have absolutely zero regrets. There are things I wish I had done differently, you know, just as with anything looking back, but you know, it was a time in my life that was beautiful in a sense and limited. And so I would just, you don't know how little time that you have. And that's not like a sad thing, because the thing that you move on to can be great, can be better, as with Genius. But still, you don't know how little time, how short of a time that you have. And if you're working on a project, even if the project succeeds, let alone fail. So just really think about how you're using your time, because it's less than you think you have. And so, you know, that's kind of pretty annoying advice, because you don't really get it until you've lived it. In my opinion, I certainly would not have done anything with that. advice, but when it comes to, you know, just all of the day-to-day details, looking at your email, looking at all this stuff, like you are probably going to end it with a full to-do list. Like if you look, like the day we sold the company, like if you looked at my to-do list, I probably have a billion things on there about like all the things I was, you know, it's like, didn't matter. And again, amazing outcome, but could I have spent that time better? Who knows in terms of results, but like looking back, it's like, it was more limited than I thought. And looking forward, I think that's something I'm always going to try to think about. You really have to be, ruthless is the wrong word because it implies like a sort of sternness or whatever, but it is a great challenge to be able to, it can often, the act of figuring out what is actually important and working on it can often feel not rude, but like kind of very unnatural, you know, I think. And you don't want to be like a weird, you know, robot or whatever. Like there is sort of like this whole thing about like anti meetings culture, which I actually think is kind of overblown. Like meetings are kind of, you know, some amount is good. You got to talk to people or whatever. And that's, you don't want to just go, yeah, send me an email. You know, you don't want to overblow that, but you know, just kind of what is important is easier to see in retrospect in life. And for me, and you know, in terms of Web3, you know, it's a tricky question because as I said, like, you know, one way to, look at it as I'm looking for my next thing. You know, that's one way to look at it. It's probably what I would say if I were like, you know, so, you know, Tom, you did this other thing and now what's that? Well, I'm kind of looking for my next thing, but I don't think that's like kind of really a good way to do it. Like if you go out and you say, I'm looking for my next thing, it's really hard to know how to do that, especially in an area where you don't know anything, especially at the beginning when I really didn't know anything. So really what I'm doing is I'm trying to just do things that are, you know, cool and things that make money basically, you know, and that is a difference from before when I was doing this last, when I was 25, I was purely focused on things that were cool. Now I have a kind of a more of a belief after the whole, you know, Genius era of, you know, not making money early enough. That was something I regretted with Genius. I'm focused on like taking up work that will be, you know, important enough to get paid for it. But I don't have a concrete plan or timeline with it. I'm just happy to be, you know, if you're in an important area, that is a huge part of the battle, basically. So I'm happy to be, you know, working in an important area and kind of figuring it out.
Yeah. Of course, you know, building something and kind of like seeing it blossom, it must be a beautiful thing to do. A lot of people want to share that same goal, right? You know, nowadays, even the brightest minds are kind of dissuaded from pursuing their light bulb moments because sometimes they see their intelligence as a hindrance rather than a strength. And I know you mentioned earlier with the clay, I love that example of how, you know, if you just keep on making clay, you become better at it and improve over time, this emphasis on improvement. So I guess how to specifically those who kind of overthink, in a sense, the possibilities, right? Like, let's say there's always risk associated with starting a startup, right? And oftentimes, I think the brightest minds who can build something great are often dissuaded from doing so because they're worried about the risk. So I guess what advice would you give to particularly those entrepreneurs in the sense of kind of just saying to go for it, like just do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a good question. They say like, you know, when you get, okay, so Bob Dylan has the song called My Back Pages, and I think it's a cover, whatever. But in the song, there's a lyric that says, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. And the idea is you kind of get younger because when you're younger, you think you know more or whatever, and you lose that, and you're older. So, you know, that is a real thing. Bob Dylan had a song about it. So, you know, what can you do with that? And I think, you know, one thing you can do is, you know, where you savor any optimism that you have now, you know, because it's not going up, basically. You know, there's a thing they say about like experienced programmers versus new programmers. Like new programmers look at something and think of all the reasons it might work. And experienced programmers look at something and think of all the reasons why it won't work. And that's not because they're like smarter or whatever. That's because experience in life has led them to, you know, everything being a complete disaster, you know, all the time, which is what building technology is actually like. But if you're younger and you see, okay, this could work, and let me fill in some of the gaps and that could work. And so you might be actually capable of doing something. But both mindsets are important. You kind of have to know which one that you are, you know, doing. You know, it's like starting a company. Like, yes, you have to throw caution to the wind. You have to try it, and you're going to get things out of it that aren't financial. So that's a reason to do it. But if you were asking, okay, what about investing in a company? Hey, you know, I'm a Yale grad, and you know, I'm I don't have much money, but I was able to save. I saved up $10,000. Okay, and this my friend even make it even harder. My friend or someone comes up and says, hey, would you like to be an angel investor in this company? And this company, I look at, I like it, you know, should I invest in it? Should I throw caution to the wind and invest my $10,000 in this company? They say minimum is 25 grand, but for you, we'll take your $10,000. And this is not an idle question, right? Because this is not $100,000. There's, you know, anyone who saves, you know, $10,000 within reach. So should you invest in a startup? And the answer is definitely not. definitely not. And why is that? Because the thing that you're going to invest in is guaranteed to fail. 100% will fail. There's no chance. You will definitely lose your money. And yet, investing your time is kind of worth more than 10 grand. If you think about it, you might be giving up a lot of money. You might be giving up a lot of social approval, you know? And yet, so why start the company? And, you know, I think there is a, I think it's kind of like a mystery in a way. You do kind of have to say, you know, because should you invest in your own company? No, you know, that's different. You don't want to have the risk multiplied on top of each other, but the risks are the same. And I would say start the company, but don't invest in companies. And yet, you know, there are things, you know, with starting a company, it's like you have to have a delusion to do it. Because if you look at the business model, which you're not even going to make when you're first starting a company, you've never looked at a business model before, you've never made a business model, you've never, you know, done any accounting stuff. You probably don't even know what revenue is. I don't even think they teach what revenue is at Yale, right? Like, it's kind of crazy, right? Because they teach you some law stuff if you want it, but they don't teach you anything about accounting, which is just as interesting and important, but whatever. So there's no way you're going to have any model here. But if you did make a model, what you would see is, wow, like everything has to go perfectly for this to work. And that's not going to happen. So this is guaranteed to fail. So you can't look at it like that. You have to be statistical in some context of life, which is statistically all startups fail, so don't invest in them. But then you have to have some belief in your ability to find the right answer, not roll the dice, have the right answer come up. Because when you roll the dice, it never comes up. And that's the delta. But it doesn't mean you should be delusional about every aspect of the business. You know, you can't just go in and say, you know, hey, like everything has to go right for this to work. I'm going to find the right answer. But oh, well, actually, even if everything goes right, this won't work. So just try it anyway. It won't work, right? Like it catches up to you. You know, you can figure out the answer when your back is against the wall in cases that you thought were hopeless. And that can, you know, that means you're special, but you're also not special. If your company does not make money, it will go out of business. Like this is a situation where Genius found itself in, where we for a long time had an amazing product that grew and all this kind of great stuff was happening, but we didn't make money. And that was not a problem until it really, really, really was a problem. And we ended up solving it in a good way, but it was a lot of work and a change in my entire headspace that I wish I had done earlier. You are not special in that way. And so if the spreadsheet, you know, if there's no possible way that it'll be a success, it won't work. So, you know, it's kind of just awareness of this kind of thing. Like there's no easy answer here. It's a dialectic, you know, you got to have the two opposing ideas in your mind. The, you know, I called it in the talk we did, I called it the historical approach versus the philosophical approach, where, you know, the historical approach or the statistical approach. Statistical approach, yeah, all startups fail. The philosophical approach is, here are my theories about why this one might work. They're opposed. You have to do, you know, both of them. But, you know, overall, I think you get stuff even if you fail. You also lose a lot of things. If you fail, you basically ruins your life. Sorry, it's like really bad. But it, you know, you get a lot of things. And you get to meet a lot of people. You get to work with people who you're not friends with, you know, which is a really powerful thing. And, you know, you get to kind of, you know, have a chance at creating a good place to work, a place that you wish you could have worked at, you know, a place where people try to do a good job and are rewarded for that, you know, and then you also kind of have to pay the price of managing that whole thing, which is really, really hard. But you get a lot of stuff from doing it, even if you fail. And so I am very much pro, you know, trying stuff out, starting companies. But I will say this. There is no right path, right? Like this is part of the theory here. You've got to figure it out. And yet with companies, there is often marketed to be a right path. Starts with, you know, in our case, Y Combinator, and ends with going public, right? Like, this is like the path, right? And I would just question that. You know, I think we had an amazing experience raising venture capital and amazing support from our investors. Although, you know, you always, not for me, but just in general, if someone says, hey, this is great, but they got money from it, it's like, you know, we were also part of a system that has, you know, problems. And I think, you know, for us, I think it was the right decision, what we did, because what we were trying to do, we raised whatever, but it wasn't the only decision that we had. And it won't be the only decision that you have out there. Are there other mechanisms by which you can avoid the, you know, glamour of VC, which is not to say that VC is bad, but just you should really think about it because it's marketed as the pack, you know? And I think when it comes to Web3 stuff, you know, DAOs, this kind of thing, like organizing people, you know, I got all kinds of problems with DAOs. DAOs are bad too or whatever, but it's another path. You know, it's something that didn't exist 10 years ago. It exists now. I would really be thinking about these alternative paths from a first principle standpoint, because it's being invented right now and there's more than one way to do it. And if you look around at like what success is, like even when we did our thing at Yale and even with Genius, like people get literally, they get their thing written down, raise this amount of money, right? Which everyone will tell you, of course, that's not the goal, but everyone still treats it like that. So it's like, this is like a thing you have to, you know, work with. So careful with that kind of thing.
Awesome. You gave so many crystal clear insights from the perspective of being realistic, being having a very clear path, but also taking on so many challenges that entrepreneurship now presents, dealing with huge conglomerates and giants in the market, as well as the emerging technology and how to adapt that to something that you want to build. But yeah, thank you so much for all your insights and coming on today. It was such a pleasure to talk to you and to hear all about your thoughts and insights and advice.
Thanks, really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then real quickly, how was your time at Yale, homecoming, the panel? How was it?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, Yale's great. I think, you know, while I was there, I was kind of stressed about stuff. It kind of goes back to what I was saying about the time that you have, you know, like how much time, probably just chill and have a good time. And again, I'm sure some good thing came from working hard, but I was stressed, all kinds of stuff, but it was really a beautiful time there. And when I go back, you know, we went to all the cute restaurants, so the Ivy Walk closed, I saw. And then we went to the game, Princeton game, not the game, which was cool. And yeah, I think, you know, Yale's great. I love going back. And, you know, let me just say that like everyone there, you all, everyone seems so advanced. So it's like, but then again, the game's harder too, I think maybe. So, you know, it's both. But, you know, when I was there, there was no, you know, Facebook was founded, you know, Facebook started in 2004. I graduated in 2006. So, you know, it's a different universe. So, you know, I think, you know, take good that there's all this stuff going on and everyone's at a high level, but also don't get, you know, don't get too wrapped up in it. You know, I was fortunate enough to live, you know, it's like before I saw it happen, you know, I lived outside of it a little bit, but it's, you know, don't get too wrapped up in it and enjoy yourself. And yeah, it's great. This is a great pod, great time at Yale. And, you know, just believe in yourself, you know, seriously. That's the thing. It's like, you know, you, believe in yourself sounds like a corny thing, but if you think about it, right, you know, it's like there are so many experiences in life, so many situations in life where it is literally impossible to say what is going to happen. You know, like if you are, you know, one trivial example would be you're kind of looking at the, you know, that's not such a good example. I mean, you know, are you going to, you know, get into a school or something, but that you kind of can know something about. You can know if you didn't turn in the application or something like that. So application's not a great way, but there's so many situations in life, you know, closing a deal would be one example, you know, where it's someone's judgment call based on no application or, you know, whether you're going to be able to, you know, launch a piece of software in time that it doesn't have any bugs, you know. When it comes to blockchain development, a bug can cost you a lot of money. So you don't know what's going to happen. And so you're presented with this choice. You can believe it's going to be bad or you can believe it's going to be good. And both of those are equally valid, but one of them gets a better result. And yet people don't want to do it. You know, so when I say believe in myself, yourself, I'm not saying like, you know, some totally trivial thing. I'm saying in very specific, ambiguous situations, you know, realize that it will be better results wise if you can believe in yourself and do it and act on the on that basis, and it will feel better and get better results, and yet hard to do. So believe in yourself. Great pod. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Founder Podcast Series. Be sure to check out yes@yale.org to learn more about entrepreneurship at Yale. And stay tuned for more content on inspiration and insights from successful entrepreneurs from the Yale community.